Hey everybody, welcome to How to Build a Village podcast. This is the first podcast episode of this kind, of this style. Just gonna wing it, so thank you for listening. Let me know what you think. Any feedback is always appreciated. So first of all, before I start plunging into this, I just want to touch base on maybe a little bit about me, my experience, and what I hope to achieve with this project. And we'll go in from there. In this episode, we'll talk particularly about components behind creating villages or communities, and basic patterns to look out for and to recognize. So I could say, you know, my journey has several origins. You know, maybe the first and biggest one has been when I decided to leave the Merchant Marine Academy that I went to right after high school. And that's when I took a nosedive into the depths of my soul as I was forced to figure out what the hell my intuition was telling me, because I was there and I felt like I shouldn't have been there. I didn't know why. I just was very confused. But fortunately, I had many great mentors there whom I've got to know really well, who've helped me explore my what my intuition was urging me towards. And so one night, you know, one of them told a story about a herd of buffalo, and you know, there was, I think, a pack of wolves, you know, that went for and isolated one of the calves, and the whole herd just ran away, left the calf behind. And they've got to it, they circled around and they started going at it, but before they were able to really kill the calf, the herd was already starting to turn around and regroup, and miraculously charged and drove the wolves away. But the moral of the story there was, sometimes we are pushed away from what we are supposed to be, or in other words, we allow fear to drive us away to whom we should really be. So the returning of the herd, driving away the wolves, represents the charge of courage, driving fear away and reclaiming, you know, your original essence, which is represented in this story by the baby calf. And so that story made me reflect, what was it that was driving me away from my, you know, my essence, I guess. You know, I've sort of been dilly-dallying into this, you know, somehow into the military academy. And I know why I was there or what I was even doing there. And that could be a very dangerous thing, you know, it depends on your own circumstance. But when you're not being who you really want to be, it's a dangerous game you're playing. So I figured from that point on, I knew it there. I knew it. I, you know, after much self-awareness, self-growth, and self-inquiry, you know, I feel like I reached a little bit of a eureka moment, you know, something, you know, visions I had, dreams I've had. It's very hard to explain in words, but I knew I had to go, and I knew where I was headed. So I left, and to make the story short, to make this all short, you know, I'm going to just limit to the next milestones of which propel me towards the direction of sustainable communities, eco-villages, and so on. So about a year later, decided to wing a trip to southern Brazil to, you know, but I had no money, so, or a little bit of it, and, you know, but I wanted to travel, you know, I was going to travel with or without money. And I've decided the way to do that was, you know, there was a thing called woofing, you know, volunteering on farms where they would give you, you know, a place to sleep and some food in exchange for your labor. So I decided to go to southern Brazil with a good friend of mine, Matt McNew, because of this very attracting aspect of traveling we never were aware of. And arriving there and working there, living there, I fell in love with that lifestyle. A lifestyle I've never really got to know before, growing up in the States, or, you know, in other words, in suburbia, more or less. You know, I've never got to experience a true, authentic agrarian lifestyle with with an intimate community of friends and family, and doing the work of harvesting coffee beans, but in the process of doing so, you know, having meaningful personal exchanges with everyone there, and not being burdened with unnecessary forms of stress that you would see in the city of, you know, going through traffic or this and that, bills, whatever. No. It all seemed just super authentic. And at evenings, we would have great times, you know, having meaningful conversations, playing games, whatever, you know, with other travelers that were there. Most were from France. And that was another eureka moment of mine. And since then, gone many other, you know, many long trips with very little money. So it made things very interesting and perhaps a little bit more, you know, more stressful than necessary, but it was good. And I had a lot of authentic experiences because of it. And from that moment on, fast forward, I found myself studying. Well, first of all, you know, I finished school with, you know, studying civil engineering, and went on to study more, you know, permaculture concepts and working in agricultural settings, doing all kinds of work, anything you can name, of from milking goats to working on agroforestry plantations to, you know, biodynamic farming on highly intensive vegetable growing, hen, cows, and anything, all of it, donkeys, whatever. I went to take a course in Eco Village called Finhorn in Scotland, and that's when I learned more of the best practices of creating and solidifying true, long-lasting, sustainable communities. And what was it that made communities fail? And what was it that made communities successful? And there were patterns that were recognized through the errors of others. And with a current statistic of 90% of aspiring eco-village always fail, just like businesses, because each eco-village beginning is kind of like, you know, a new business venture. And so, you know, it was interesting because at Finhorn, they began in the 50s as just a, you know, with a couple. They eventually grew into what they are today. I think their residency, I don't know the current numbers, but I would guess maybe between 200, 300. I could be completely wrong, but that was, I would say that would be the size more or less. And it was very interesting to see the sophistication and the amount of good positive changes they've been helping to create around the world, you know, through GEN, Global Eco Village Network, a network of over 10,000 eco village communities around the world in Africa, Asia, Latin America. And most interesting of all is perhaps what's going on in Africa with the government of Senegal alone. Just in that country alone, they're in the process of transforming 14,000 communities into eco villages. That's insane that a country is leading that kind of initiative. Same with Burkina Faso and in Morocco, Egypt, and Zimbabwe doing similar things. So that finally leads me to what this episode is going to be about. What are those fundamental things to recognize and plan for when creating an eco village? The fundamental elements. You may have heard of, you know, the triple bottom line in terms of sustainability. That's, you know, sustainable economy, sustainable social structure, or, you know, and then obviously the environmental ecological component. But interestingly, what I've come to learn was that there's a fourth element, and perhaps the most important element, because, you know, those communities that always have failed have failed due to a major lack in, or complete disregard for this fourth and major element. And that, as I've come to learn in Finhorn, was the glue, if you will, of what holds it all together. And what is that glue? That glue is, you know, you could call it spiritual glue. You could call it culture. Basically, it's what makes the cohesiveness of the community, that no matter what happens, especially conflicts, and conflicts are always bound to happen in any given community, their commitment to to surpass any conflict, towards empathetic communication, giving the benefit of the doubt, valuing spiritual principles over ego or over personal gains. That's the major difference. And looking past other people's shortcomings. So, you know, I've came to this course expecting to learn what I, you know, typically learned in the past through my engineering curriculum, how to technical how-tos in regards to, let's say, renewable energy, natural building, of which I'll definitely go into. But for the purposes of this conversation, what I've went into expecting the technical how-to ended up being more of a social how-to. So what do you do when you have a major disagreement with someone, even resulting in a heated argument? You know, rather than pour gasoline on the fire and say, you know, you don't know anything, I'm right, you're wrong, and I'm going to stay in my position until you give up. They've taught more to recognize, okay, well, let me put my ego down for a second. Let me see what this person is coming from. Let me try to understand his point of view, where he's getting at. Is there something perhaps I'm missing? So it was really eye-opening. So now let me go out and outline these four elements and provide key bullet points and examples of each. So as listed, these four elements of eco-village design are as follows. You have the ecological key. That includes, you know, more of the technical know-hows, and that goes into agriculture, sustainable agriculture, regenerative ecosystem design, and natural building, renewable energy, you know, all that good stuff, appropriate technology. And then the next one is the economic key. So how to make such a community independently in this arena, you know, in this element, there's local currencies, you know, local bartering systems, perhaps, social entrepreneurship, generating the vitality economically within the community, generating wealth and keeping that wealth inside. Then you have the social key, the social element with that. That's more of the organization of decision making, of how the community governs itself. And there's definitely best practice in this. And this is perhaps the most difficult of practicing, of getting fluent in. And then finally, what I mentioned before is the worldview key. You know, that's where the culture plays a key component into all of this. And this, you could perhaps fit in the spiritual element into the community, as you know, if everyone has a spiritual commitment, no matter what the religion is. You know, in Finhorn, there was no religion, no dogmas, no nothing. It was, you know, everyone had a spiritual commitment, spiritual practice, but everyone, you know, connected through that same commitment. So you know, I've been in other communities apart from Finhorn that were really spiritual as well, but you know, people were monks, you know, Buddhist monks living with Christians, and you know, they live together, and their mutual commitment to their spiritual discipline is what made the whole thing work. And you know, this certain key, the worldview key, acknowledges, points out that there are always an underlying, often unspoken, and sometimes hidden patterns to the cultural element that strongly influence and may in fact predetermine economic, social, and eco relationships. So they're basically what holds the other three components together, making the triple bottom line legitimate work indeed. So you could also look at this as perhaps the consciousness key to eco-village design, the consciousness element, which often precedes the physicality. You know, I remember, you know, having to sit through some corporate meetings or corporate lectures on the triple bottom line when trying to talk about sustainability. And I remember sitting there thinking, this is a load of bullshit, but I don't know why, because what they're saying logically makes sense, but it's just a load of horseshit, and I don't know what's missing here. And basically this is it. That
to hold those three elements together, you need those three elements need to have some form of guidance. You know, each group, whether company, community, whatever, you know, they have their commitments, let's say, in these three areas, but those areas are guided through what their interpretations may be of the nature of reality. So here, before I move on to the next element, as we're still talking about the worldview key or the consciousness key, I've written down some actionable steps as outlined by the curriculum I'm looking at from my course. And here they are. They're as follows, you know. So it definitely helps, and on a personal note, to have a regular spiritual practice, whether that includes meditation, prayer, or yoga. Keeping a daily journal of dreams, insights, and observations. Deepening connection with nature. And draft clear and creative paths to personal health. And to become an agent of change, or change agent, a contributor to a new world. All right, so let's plunge into the social element now. And here, first thing to note is perhaps, you know, what we're evolved for, what kind of social structures we're meant to be in, as looking back into archaeological evidence. And there's been a really good book on this written called Tribes or something like that. You know, and many others too, honestly. And they all point out that, you know, we do really well in small groups, you know, hand in hand with nature, but most particularly, highly dependent on one another, surviving, very harsh circumstances, and banding together to form a community and living hand in hand with nature again, you know, reactivates that part of ourselves that we've negated after our domestication as a civilization and living in cities in very comfortable environments. And again, this is where it's important to recognize that here conflicts will arise. And since everyone's challenged to the core, you know, people are going to snap. And it's important to be able to, you know, manage that, those energies harmoniously without breaking things apart, you know. So the skills in this element are perhaps the most important skills to know: conflict management, empathetic communication, and really goes a long way. It helps when, you know, all peoples in such a group are committed to their own personal growth and mutual understanding and respect and practicing loving kindness. And if this sounds a bit intimidating, it's much better than, I guess, what the majority of us are dealing with now, which is, you know, from family breakdowns to rampant addictions, social alienation, and also there's an interesting note here from that I've learned with GEN, predatory individualism. And, these are, you know, a list of the side effects of our current global economic system. So, you know, changing these unnatural sick challenges to a whole new set of challenges that are more aligned with our nature. So in front of me, I got a whole bunch of bullet points, notes I've taken from this and from when I was there. So, you know, let me just go down a list here, or, you know, just reading through some of these, which are good bits of information to keep, you know, be aware of. So, you know, the social benefits too, you know, at, you know, making such a commitment and creating eco villages, being part of an eco village are, you know, safe and protected place, to raise children and to take care of the elderly. There's more time for family and friends and less time spent at stressful jobs or commuting to those jobs. You know, there are more opportunities for homegrown businesses or cottage industry. By cottage industry, you know, that's, you know, basically the business manufacturing activity carried in any person's home. That's the definition of cottage industry. But there's opportunities for those. You know, more room, opportunities for collaboration with friends in the community. You know, there's opportunities for creative pursuits, such as with music or theater, more shared meals, which is much more of a regular feature, you know, shared office space, shared shop, shared rec space. So that means, you know, less purchasing, reducing the need to earn.
lessening the stress burden of having, you know, high paid job or worrying about that. And you know, anything political associations are often centered in the eco-village setting, also with anything educational. Basically, you know, eco-village has become a breeding ground of information, inspiration, and all that I've seen. You know, official eco-villages that I've stayed and worked at, each about maybe a month per one, I guess. You know, they all, you know, represented the same characteristics of going out to do community service or helping out the extended community, but also they were hubs of information, education. People come from all parts of the world coming to learn with them. And these four ones in particular that I've been to, including Finhorn, are, you know, ones that are recognized under this framework by outlined as by GEN. But apart from that, I've been with many, many other communities not following this exact framework, but more or less an ecological community, so to speak. And also, you know, consumerism, addiction, and crime are practically non-existent because, you know, everyone's fulfilled with meaningful interactions, meaningful relationships. You know, and there's a possibility for integration with the you know, integrating the disabled, elderly, and other challenged groups in a way that gives them a richer, fuller life. You know, all in all, basic human needs are met much easier, and there's more leisure time. And you know, of course, there's, you know, lots of work to do in these types of settings, but it's incredible how much more time you've got for creative pursuits to relax and also get things done and be productive. It's just the, you know, experience it for myself going back to live in the city or looking at a job, commuting. The more I flip-flop between these two worlds, the more it makes so much sense to go the other way, and the more insane this other world seems. And it's also interesting too, you know, Damanhur Ecovillage in Italy, another really well-known ecovillage. You know, I haven't been there personally, but, you know, meeting people from there, you know, they tell me that, you know, they Americans in particular have a very hard time integrating with the community, you know, trying to live there at least long term, because, you know, here in the States, we probably have the most individual, like hyper individualized paradigm. So that means, you know, more so within our country and perhaps maybe other ones as well. I don't know. I'm speaking from my own point of view. Our own point of view, whoever's in the States, you know, there's more intentions needed to learn the subtleties of constructive, respectful, and mutually beneficial interaction within any community setting until it becomes second nature. And that takes some time. You know, it takes a lot getting used to. Coming from this paradigm into an eco-village setting, it took me some time. I'm, you know, and then leaving and coming back, it, you know, feels like I have to go through that process again, but it comes a little bit more quicker the second time around. But basically, that's something to be aware of. And a good way to look at this in a social sense is it's like a garden, you know, community. If the field of human interaction is well tended and taken care of, it will grow abundant fruits. And it, I can't tell you the warmth and the welcome feeling I've received being in lots of these communities. But also, you know, I have to point out that there's been instances or communities where I felt the complete opposite. So basically, you know, their pressure cooker of emotions for good or for bad. So that's why it's extra important to be aware of these social dimensions, to be aware of conflict, how to manage these conflicts, because if managed improperly, and I'm speaking from personal experience, it could get very ugly, very bad, and it becomes an environment where clans are more pronounced, you know, you know, conflicts between groups even, you know, it makes a very threatening atmosphere, is very highly uncomfortable. And that's why a lot of these communities fail, because they can't handle it, and it gets so polarized so fast if you're not careful. So that leads me, you know, there's the great need
to learn the deep art of forgiving and asking for forgiveness. It needs to be instilled and intertwined with everyday life as to not allow bitterness to grow, whatever may happen. So now what does it look like when we try to organize ourselves, when we try to govern ourselves? This was a very interesting element. And there's many ways to do this. You know, there's consensus decision making. This also could be a little problematic. You know, it demands that every single person agrees to every single decision, which could be incredibly ineffective. So there's been reiterations to this, and so that's what's called sociocracy. So it's more of a consent decision making process, and this setup is pretty interesting. The process was created by an electrical engineer and an entrepreneur who utilized, you know, certain patterns he recognized within cybernetic principles, within closed loop systems and feedback mechanisms, and he applied it to managing his own business, and in which decisions are made in double looping circles. His name is Gerard Edinburgh. I think that's how you pronounce his name. And it proved to be very successful. And this is what's been adopted all throughout the eco-villages. I've seen it in practice in Colombia and in Scotland and also in Tamara in Portugal. And so it becomes a way of deciding on things without being it permanent. You know, it basically proceeds with the best decision at the moment. That's probably the crucial element, knowing that it could be changed in the future according to feedback that the group identifies together. And it's also an opportunity to practice an art form too for the facilitator. So there's a facilitator that's that takes responsibility for managing and leading the group. And this facilitator is identified as the servant leader, who has the trust of the group but no power. And you know, going to the origin of the word to facilitate, you know, means to make easy. And it's important that this person has a lot of patience, emotional balance, and a key ability to listen. So to wrap up this discussion of the social key, it's four individual steps, skills to continuously work on. It's a good idea to learn how to organize a group, to forgive to ask for forgiveness, as we talked about, how to forge a common vision, creating community glue, creating an atmosphere of trust and goodwill, and developing qualities of empathy and reconciliation in relationships with others. All right, now we have the economic element, and this is perhaps the most exciting because given our crumbling global economic system, it's important that we have vibrant, locally based alternative currencies, you know, like new shoots bursting forth when everything else crumbles in on itself. There's a whole discussion on this in many other areas that I frankly don't feel qualified to explain or teach about, but there's plenty of good resources out there and about our global economic system. It's a lot of research, a lot of understanding. It takes some time, a lot of patience. But if you stick with it, you seek out the truth in this whole thing, it would all make sense. And you know, a good person I like to who I feel teaches this subject extremely well, his name is Mike Maloney, and he's created a series of episodes called Hidden Secrets of Money on YouTube. I found that to be an incredibly useful educational resource in learning about our economic system and the fragility of our times. And this is a very exciting space for social enterprises, which is a very big feature of eco-villages, in which they're engaged in providing employment to the marginalized and disadvantaged. I see this commonly throughout communities, and many of them are committed to the restoration of degraded ecosystems and also providing for community needs simultaneously. And we'll get more into that, into the ecological design, perhaps maybe not in this episode, but in other episodes. And there's social enterprises dedicated to child care for the elderly, and also the biggest one is supply of healthy organic food, while also making a reasonable profit.
And really interesting as well is the creation of community banks and currencies. And in Finnhorn, they had their own currency created called the Echo. And that was neat. You know, I bought some food using just the Echo, bought some service only with the Echo. And they've had that in circulation. I don't know for how long, but it helps to create the wealth, helps to maintain the wealth within the community without it leaving, and therefore not affected by whatever craziness is going on with the global economic system and through inflation and all those other vulnerabilities. So a good way to look at this, you know, creating an eco-village is like, you know, claiming back economic control. And this requires to undertake a serious study of money and resources flowing into and out of any local economy. And this they call, you know, the need to plug the leaks. And basically that means, you know, what product, services, you know, that any group is currently enjoying that they could provide from themselves. Basically, in other words, for how can you make yourselves more resilient? And this leads me to a quote by the economist Richard Douthwaite. I don't know if that's the correct name to pronounce his name. But here he says, if people living in an area cannot trade among themselves without using money issued by outsiders, their local economy will always be at the mercy of events elsewhere. The first step for any community aiming to become more self-reliant is therefore to establish its own currency system. So there's been identified two ways of addressing the problem of plugging the leaks. You know, one, create own local exchange trading systems, also known abbreviated as LET systems, or community currency system. And I'll do more episodes and explain maybe more of the technicalities of each of these. And two, community banks or other legal structures to permit community members and their family and friends to invest in community enterprises and projects. And now, that leads us to the fourth and final element, the ecological element. And this is something that is my personal interest, coming from an engineering background and working on farms, a lot of farms already. And this, unfortunately, I will not do in this video. I'll do it in the next one. And, because that's more technical, it's more of a different kind of conversation. So I feel for the purposes of this own podcast, this is already getting a little bit long. I'll end it at that. So I hope you've enjoyed this. I hope you got a lot out of it. This is new for me. So, if you listen to this far, thank you. Please let me know how I can improve, how to make this more of an enjoyable experience for you, because this is all about you. You know, this is, what are you getting out of this? What are your goals? I encourage you to reach out to, explain your personal situation, what you aim for, what your goals are. Oh, and also, you know, I've mentioned at the very beginning, you know, I outlined my hopes for this project. And basically, I love to see this become the go-to educational resource and perhaps networking platform for creating these sorts of endeavors, perhaps maybe particularly in the United States, although there's, you know, the existing framework of the Global Eco-Village Network. So, you know, the system, the patterns, the education has been set. It's just a matter of bringing it to the point of what's the term called, the turning point. We are in very dire times right now, urgent times. We are in a very fragile economic situation, it's, I see it very important to know this very, very well. When we still have the luxuries that we are enjoying right now, before they all go away. This is the way I see it. I encourage you to embark your own personal study and investigate and open up the floor for conversations and debates. I love debates. Please, comment, leave comments, questions, reach out. You know, anything would be appreciated. So, and see you on the next episode.